Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Housing, the building and buying and furnishing of it, makes up roughly 15% of the U.S. economy. But how much of your paycheck? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 16th. Good to have you with us. We're going to start today with housing because that's the next target of the Biden administration's efforts to curb inflation. Today, the White House announced a plan to address the ongoing shortage of housing that's been driving up home prices and rents all over the country. The strategy includes enticing local governments to loosen up zoning restrictions, making it easier to build manufactured housing and the backyard cottages known as ADUs, and preserving existing affordable housing. As Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, some of these changes may take changing mindsets.
People care a lot about where they live, especially over the past few years, when they've been living there an awful lot. Erin Stumpf is a broker associate with Coldwell Banker. She works in the Sacramento region.
Zoom rooms have become highly coveted areas inside homes.
But at the same time people wanted homes with Zoom rooms, we stopped building as many homes, period, says Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com.
Our estimates suggest that we're 5.8 million single-family homes short. So we're about 4 to 5 years behind where we need to be.
The Biden administration's new plan is about catching up. Urban economist Jenny Schutz is author of the book Fixer Upper, How to Repair America's Broken Housing Systems. She says the plan includes government funds with strings attached.
We will give you money to build additional roads or transit stations, but only if you plan to use your land more efficiently to allow higher density housing around transit, to allow more moderately priced homes to be built.
But Schutz points out a lot of Americans don't want high-density housing or any kind of new development.
People like their neighborhoods the way they are, but also affluent people really like keeping their neighborhoods full of other affluent people.
Many places have banned certain kinds of homes, including manufactured housing or mobile homes, says Salim Firth with George Mason University.
It's honestly one of the few places in, you know, American civil society today where you can simply make fun of people for where they live, right? If you live in a trailer park, we can make jokes about you.
The new plan could make it easier to get loans for these kinds of homes. But economist Jenny Schutz says politicians also need to change their rhetoric.
Every presidential candidate from both parties, if they talk about housing, they talk about the American dream being homeownership and encouraging people to buy homes.
Schutz says that's an outdated way of thinking, and there should be policies to encourage other ways to build wealth. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
It's a big week for housing news. We'll have numbers on home builder sentiment, new construction, and existing home sales later this week. On Wall Street today, it's going to be swing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sticking with housing for the moment, people looking for a place to live now have some more data to consider. A new online tool allows users to look up the risk of wildfire for every property in the contiguous United States. Spoiler, half the addresses in the lower 48 face at least some level of risk. Today's launch comes as New Mexico battles its largest wildfire on record, and fires are burning in several other states. The new resource from a nonprofit called the First Street Foundation is part of a growing movement to quantify the risk from natural disasters. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Tim Halber lost his mom and dad in a wildfire 5 years ago. The Tubbs Fire started on faulty electrical equipment before whipping across Northern California's Sonoma County.
My parents were definitely a very early victim of this whole climate change concern about fires.
Halber thinks about that a lot as he looks to relocate from his home in LA to Portland, Oregon.
Now, as I house hunt, I'm absolutely considering keeping to very safe areas.
And he says the tools he has are limited.
I don't feel like I have that information. I feel like, I mean, basically I'm looking at Google Maps and thinking, okay, where are the forests? Will the rivers rise?
Kimiko Barrett, a lead analyst at Headwaters Economics, says it's not just the American West that's at risk. It's just that there's more awareness there, given the experience of the last few years.
And that's not necessarily the same situation across the country. More than anything, I think it's just worth knowing that risk is everywhere.
First Street Foundation, which is releasing its new wildfire risk tool, is one among an emerging group of players looking to model climate risk. Matthew Eby started the nonprofit 6 years ago.
I can tell you at the beginning, there definitely wasn't the same level of interest, nor was the same amount of capital or companies flowing into the space.
And he welcomes competition. Quantifying risk does influence behavior, says the University of Southern California's Matthew Kahn. He has an unpaid research partnership with First Street.
Those searching for housing search for homes that face less risk when they are confronted with this information.
Michael E. Mann, author of the book The New Climate War, has this warning.
The homes that we live in and purchase may not continue to be safe places for us to live in the future.
A fact he says people should factor into wherever they choose to live. I'm Lily Dramali for Marketplace.
National parks are more popular than ever. Many of them had record numbers of visitors last year, and that includes Big Bend in far west Texas, where conservationists worried about the impact of all those visitors are pushing to expand federal protections. A wilderness designation would protect the park's natural areas for generations. But strict federal land rules are rare in Texas, and some in the tourist economy are wary of the idea. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has that story.
At an overlook in Big Bend, Park Superintendent Bob Krummenacker shows off a sweeping view of mountains and desert lowlands.
What we're looking at, per the name of the trail, is a view of the window. And the window is this notch in the mountains, and water, when we have water, flows through that. It is a spectacular hike.
This Chihuahuan desert landscape is one of the most pristine parts of Texas, and a recently formed group called Keep Big Bend Wild is pushing for Congress to ensure it stays that way by formally declaring most of the park as wilderness.
The wilderness would preserve the things that people tell us they love about this park the most.
Wilderness areas are the most stringently protected yet still accessible types of public lands in the U.S., with limits on things like building roads and facilities. Right now, Big Bend staff has a policy of managing the park that way, but wilderness supporters say that's not enough, and they want lawmakers to act. Retired wildlife biologist Raymond Skiles is among those who say they're worried about potential overdevelopment in the park someday, perhaps to better accommodate the growing crowds. He worked at Big Bend for decades, and he says there have been plans that would have dramatically changed the park's landscape, like in the 60s, when lawmakers wanted to build a commercial airport on the edge of the park.
You know, I've seen a few of these things. That they're rare. They, you know, did not come to pass, but it wasn't because someone, you know, didn't want it to happen. And I could just see that that's, you know, that could be in the future as well.
Skiles' group Keep Big Bend Wild says that while the wilderness designation would keep anything like that failed airport plan from ever being considered again, it would not impact any existing park facilities. But just outside the park, local restaurant owner Bill Ivey says he's not convinced.
I haven't budged from being opposed to it.
It's the busy season here, and Ivy's Starlight Theater is packed. A singer belts her heart out to the crowds of visitors munching on burgers and throwing back beers. Ivy's a big player in the local tourism economy and the board president of the Brewster County Tourism Council. The council, which promotes tourism to the region and includes local business owners, has notably declined to endorse the wilderness idea. Ivy's opposition stems from when the idea was first floated decades ago. Back then, some state and local officials said they feared a wilderness designation would have made the park less accessible. Wilderness supporters promise that won't happen now, but they haven't developed a detailed proposal yet, and that's a problem for Ivy.
If we're going to endorse something or agree to something that we don't know what it is, I'm not comfortable with that.
The wilderness effort does have support from other local businesses, like River Guides, who run commercial trips in the park. Keep Big Bend Wild wants Congress to pass legislation designating the wilderness area by the start of next year. But so far, representatives and senators from Texas haven't said much about the idea, so it's far from clear if there's the political will in Washington to make it happen. In Marfa, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, am I teetering? Am I falling off?
Let's hope not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 26 points, just shy of a tenth of a percent, to finish at 32,223. The S&P 500 lost 15 points, four-tenths percent, to end at 4008. And the NASDAQ dropped 142 points, one and two-tenths percent, to close at 11,662. We heard from Stephanie Hughes that the Biden administration is supporting housing construction, including so-called entry-level homes. In related stocks, Cavco Industries, maker of modular and pre-built homes, lost 0.3%. Legacy Housing Corporation, they build tiny houses, lifted 0.6%. JetBlue is attempting a hostile takeover of low-cost airline Spirit. It's appealing to company shareholders to reject the carrier's deal with privately held Frontier Airlines early this year. JetBlue dropped just over 6%. Spirit soared almost 13.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. You've no doubt heard the term core inflation. Economists like to see what's happening generally with prices by taking out food and energy, which tend to be more sensitive to temporary factors like crop yields or what OPEC's up to. As we found out last week, the core consumer price index was up 6.2% last month from a year earlier. Now add energy and food back in, and prices were up 8.3%. And if you look at energy costs alone, they're up 30% since last year, and that has a lot of Americans struggling with their utility bills, Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Stormy Johnson pays $800 a month to rent a three-bedroom house in Kingwood, West Virginia. Last winter, she paid almost that much for her utilities, too.
Between my gas and electric, it was almost $700 a month.
When the bills first arrived, she was shocked.
During the summer months, even running like four air conditioners, my electric was no more than $150. So it was a significant jump.
Even before her utilities jumped last winter, Johnson never had quite enough money to get by. She's a single mom. Two of her three kids are still at home. And she doesn't take home that much from her job as a student support specialist in the local public schools. Just $2,200 a month.
I normally live shutoff notice to shutoff notice.
But this winter, for the first time, she wasn't able to pay the bills in full before the shutoff date. She had to set up a payment plan.
Because it increased so much.
For many low-income families, it's always been hard to pay for heat and electricity. But for middle-income families,
usually energy is affordable. And that right now is not the case.
Mark Wolf is with the National Energy Assistance Directors Association.
The major problem is rising heating oil prices, rising gasoline prices, rising natural gas prices. Across the board, all major sources of energy, both for families' homes as well as running their car, are up significantly.
Experts generally say energy costs should take up only about 6% of a household's income. Right now, Wolf says, on average, middle-income families are spending twice that, and low-income families are spending four times that.
The numbers are terrible. I mean, they're genuinely awful.
Some of the latest figures suggest that somewhere between a quarter and a third of all households in the U.S. are energy insecure.
Diana Hernandez at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health says the issue is particularly acute in the South and for people of color. And it's worse right now because the cost of everything else is going up too. Food, rent, clothes.
This is not just about energy issues per se. When other costs also increase, it means that there's less to be allocated to the utility bills.
People living right around the poverty line can apply for assistance through LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. Congress more than doubled the amount of funding for LIHEAP for this year. But even so, there's only enough to help about one in five eligible households. And with energy prices rising so much, a lot of people who are struggling don't qualify because they make too much money.
There are not a lot of programs to help middle and moderate income.
Tanya Jones is the director of energy assistance and community development at the nonprofit HeartShare Human Services.
And so they are struggling the most because after they pay their rent and then they buy food, they're not eligible for any type of assistance.
Each state has a different cutoff for LIHEAP. In West Virginia, where Stormy Johnson lives, a family of three making more than about $29,000 a year before taxes doesn't qualify. Stormy Johnson doesn't qualify.
I've always said, you know, I make too much to get any kind of help, but I don't make enough to survive.
Johnson is still paying off her winter utility bills, and she's starting to worry about how she's going to get through a hot, humid West Virginia summer.
My kids have already asked me 2 weeks ago to put the air conditioners in, and I'm like, open the windows.
Her plan is to wait as long as she can before putting those window units in. But eventually, she says, she'll have to.
It's not the actual temperature that will get you in West Virginia, but it's the humidity. When it gets really hot and humid, it's not even really safe to be outside for long periods of time. So it's almost like air conditioners are a necessity.
Those days haven't quite arrived yet. When they do, Johnson says she'll put the ACs in and turn them on, and then figure out what to cut back on so she can pay the bill. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The big quit, the great resignation, whatever you call it, a record number of people are leaving their jobs. 4.5 million people in March alone, according to the Labor Department. For some, it's because the pandemic made them realize there's something else I want to do. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has been talking to people who found a calling during the pandemic and before. First up in her series, a story from Rochester, New York.
In the basement of an old industrial building in Rochester, there's a room where Hunter Reed is leading his new life. He spends his days and nights here in front of a machine that sort of looks like a turntable with a grinding wheel that spins at high speed. All over the walls, he's scribbled elaborate mathematical patterns. What's he doing? Well, I can tell you what he's not doing. Working the parking lot at a Home Depot. A year ago, that was his job. For $12 an hour, he would put away carts and lift bags of mulch into people's cars. It was a lot of walking, back and forth, back and forth.
I had this pair of shoes that were so beaten that it was really embarrassing. I had a hole in the bottom of them, and it was like February and just raining and torrential, and I just couldn't like keep my feet dry at all.
And all day long in the parking lot, he would daydream about what he really wanted to be doing.
I just couldn't, like, I couldn't be at work anymore. It was all I was thinking about.
Hunter had recently fallen down the rabbit hole into the world of glass art. In 2019, he was piling up student debt, studying computer design, when he realized it was not for him. So he dropped out. Then, a friend made an introduction.
I had just decided I wasn't going back to college, and so he offered to hook me up with this glass artist.
Hunter had been interested in glass art since high school, so he started buying this artist's work wholesale and selling it online as a side hustle. Then in the pandemic, when that artist left town, he sold Hunter his homemade glass cutting wheel. Hunter had a bunch of marbles with trippy multicolored designs inside, and he spent hours on the wheel, cutting one into a diamond using mathematical patterns. Then he did it again. A couple weeks in, he posted one of his creations on Reddit, a diamond-cut, rainbow-colored, psychedelic-looking marble. Dozens of people messaged him, wanting to buy one. He sold six for $150 each. Suddenly, he saw a path out of his dead-end retail job, and he figured if he failed, he could always go back.
It's like a pulse check to get a minimum wage job. They treat you as replaceable because you are, right? And in the same vein, they were replaceable to me.
So he quit. Just stopped showing up. He told his partner and his parents that he got fired. He didn't think they'd understand.
Nobody in your immediate circle wants to support you quitting your job because nobody wants to tell you to take a risk and then it turn out poorly for you.
But he felt like he had to take the leap. And things went pretty well for a week. And then one day, the glass cutting wheel on which he had pinned his entire existence broke. Just collapsed in on itself. He spent days trying to fix it and eventually came up with a solution that involved drilling a hole through the axle. He got a second opinion from a friend who builds race cars.
And I was like, if I do this, will it kill me?
She gave him the green light and the fix worked, but then the wheel broke again. So he sold some of his stuff and bought a brand new one for $700. And this is where, financially, things started to get tricky. Today, Hunter is making more money than he did at Home Depot, but he has new expenses, like he got tired of working from his backyard, so he rented a studio. Plus, he's working 60, sometimes 70 hours a week, and his body hurts. He gets shoulder pain from all the repetitive sweeping motions on the wheel. Also, he designs his marbles to be viewed with one eye closed.
I didn't know that my eye socket and part of my brain, like the muscles, could be tight there.
Before, he was making art for himself. Now he needs it to pay his bills. He turned a passion into a job. And it's stressful. Like, if he posts a marble on Instagram and it doesn't get many likes, he's thinking,
you know, am I teetering? Am I falling off? Do people not like my work as much as they used to? Am I doing something wrong?
Home Depot was just a job. He wasn't lying in bed at night thinking about the carts. But, you know, that's not the kind of life he was looking for. And now?
You couldn't stop me from doing this if you tried. Like, the bombs could drop tomorrow, whatever, and me and two cockroaches, I'd be trying to show them my marbles.
It's been a year since Hunter quit, and he started to get into glass blowing, too, to make the marbles that he later cuts into diamond shapes.
Yeah, black stuff is carbon from having extra propane. Producing a cooler flame.
It's cool to watch. He puts these little dots of hot-colored glass on a clear bulb and then spins it around over a blowtorch flame, like honey on a stick. And suddenly, he's made an oval-shaped marble with a brightly colored spiral inside. One of the things Hunter likes about this work is that his marbles have no productive use. They exist simply to be admired.
People call them pocket vibes or pocket protectors, which is something cool to look at when you're out in the world.
Hunter's only 23. So he doesn't know if this marble thing is forever. But he says it makes sense to him right now. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
I looked up those marbles online. Pretty darn cool. If you or someone you know has pursued a professional calling, how did it turn out? We'd love to hear about it at marketplace.org.
This final note before we go, the mass shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York on Saturday that killed 10 people is not on its face an economic story, but there is an important economic backdrop, to be sure. Police say the accused gunman targeted a Tops supermarket in East Buffalo because he knew black people would be shopping there. And how did he know? Buffalo is one of the most segregated cities in America. As the New York Times reports, 85% of the city's black population lives on the east side. People in the community fought for years for a full-service grocery store in what had been a food desert before the Tops Market opened in 2003. In a statement, Tops said the store on Jefferson Avenue would remain closed until further notice. All right, here's your Monday moment of economic context from the Wall Street Journal. Among the biggest U.S. companies, median CEO pay last year reached $14.7 million. It was the sixth record-setting year in a row. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.